You live inside a cave, barely get by, the rest of us are trying. I've got no time for feeling sorry. That's Paramore. I'm Blake Murphy. This is Jays Talk Plus. The Jays closed out their time at the Oakland Coliseum on the weekend. And while they did send the reverse boycott night crowd home happy with a J.J. Bleda walk-off on Friday, they managed to claw back, take the series. Kevin Gausman's first career complete game shutout on Saturday. The call-up of Spencer Horwitz. Another huge day from Isaiah Kiner-Falefa on Sunday. It all got the Jays 2 of 3. So while you'd like to feel sorry for Oakland fans, and you certainly can from a fandom and community and treatment of the owner level, can't feel too bad about taking two, including in dramatic fashion yesterday in extra innings. There are teams that are actually trying to win here. And yeah, speaking of caves, to go down the Plato route here, perception is not always reality. We may have perceived that the last 2 months of baseball or so have been quite poor. The reality is that somehow the Jays are only 2 games out of a playoff spot. So even though they're only a game under 500 still, even though they quote unquote only took 2 of 3 against Oakland in a very sweepable series, here they are, just 2 games out with a whole lot of baseball left to play. We got a fun show today setting up this Brewers series. Tim Dillard will join us a little later. Caleb Joseph, who's on Blue Jay Central all weekend, will join us to break down that series. And Ashley Stevenson, who is now a coach with the Vancouver Canadiens, the Blue Jays High A affiliate. She will also join us. She is going into the Canadian Baseball Hall of Fame this weekend in St. Mary's, Ontario. So we'll talk to her about that. Before we do any of that, though, let's bring in one of our absolute favorite guests. It's Caitlin McGrath of The Athletic. Caitlin, how are we doing?
I'm good. How are you?
I am good. So I guess of all the things that happened on the weekend, the most maybe relatable from a person in sports media and maybe also just from a human standpoint, Yusei Kikuchi kind of accidentally getting in the way and then feeling really awkwardly about it after. Where does that rank in terms of bizarre Blue Jays highlights for you?
I feel like it was such a strange moment, something that I've never seen before, obviously. I felt bad for him too, because I think Kikuchi as a person is just very nice and kind and gentle. He's very polite. And so I think like he in particular would be mortified by that, as you could kind of tell. I think some quotes that he said afterwards kind of indicated he was very, very embarrassed and, you know, felt very bad for not just getting in the way, but kind of disrupting the game. So all that kind of stuff, like of all the people, I think he would have felt the most bad. It's just like in his personality, be so kind and gentle. So definitely an awkward moment. I don't know. I guess they got the out anyway. So I don't think the A's can be too upset.
Yeah. And the audio picked up some nice chirping toward Austin Adams. What if you pitched as well as you talk trash, we'll say, since that wasn't the word that was said. And yeah, Yusei Kikuchi saying through a translator after the game, I just wanted to create a little hole and hide inside of it. Nice for the Blue Jays to get one last very Oakland memory, I guess. And there were a few different Oakland things over the course of the weekend. Caitlin, we talked to your colleague Melissa Lockhart at The Athletic on Friday about reverse boycott night and everything that was going on before the game. We saw Chris Bassitt pick up some dirt from the mound after his last start there. He obviously had a very long time there and finishes with the second best ERA of all time at Oakland Coliseum. So there was a lot going on for a weekend series against the A's. And Caitlin, the Jays took 2 of 3. What was your concern level after Friday night's game where J.J. Bleda walks it off in the bottom of the ninth, one pitch from Chad Green? We were just coming off of these two really good, really nice victories against the Orioles. Were you kind of like, oh no, here's the other shoe? Or how'd you feel coming out of that one before the rest of the series?
I wouldn't say my concern level was any different than, you know, it ever is watching these Blue Jays, because I've seen them for 2 years kind of take one step forward, two steps back a lot of the times when it comes to offense and when it comes to games. It's just they've had a really hard time being that consistent performer. And so I think when you see against the A's, and it's not so much that, the walk-off or the way they lost, but it's more so just the them not scoring consistently. That's the biggest issue. Obviously, we saw that, you know, look like it might have impacted them again or affected them again in the last game. Obviously, they did well to tie the game after giving up the lead, and then they did well to score in extras, which is something you obviously need to do when you're facing a team like the A's. Boudet's got a break. Mason Miller only pitched one inning. So you take advantage of, you know, the Oakland bullpen and you score three and it's enough to win and all that kind of stuff. So that was a good response. But I think overall, you're just still a little bit concerned about this offense. You know, are they able to make the proper adjustments? Are they able to score on a consistent basis? And yes, like every team is going to have games where they're not going to score a lot. But I think, which is the Blue Jays, it's just we have not seen enough of a sample size yet of them being able to, like, score consistently. Obviously, the, you know, runs in the first inning has a long thing that's now over, finally. But you never know when that new streak is going to begin. So I think it's just, like, you know, my concern level is not, I would say, high or low. It's just kind of what it is with this team, kind of wanting to observe them and see if they can finally get on a roll that's more consistent when it comes to scoring, because that's really the only way that they're going to be able to get through what is now going to be a very tough month of June. Now that they've finished their series against the A's, they're facing basically teams that are all ahead of them in record, a couple first place teams, the Brewers, Cleveland Guardians. So it's going to be a tough schedule that's really going to show you, you know, are the Blue Jays legit going to make a push here, or are they kind of the team that they've showed us to be over the first 2.5 months?
Yeah, the Brewers and Guardians, a combined record of 80-49. These are two pretty good teams, even with the Central Division caveats there. And Caitlin, to your point about the offense, the Jays are coming off a two-week stretch where they went 9-4, which is good, but quality of competition was pretty low. And they're still, you know, that has only brought them up to 25th in runs per game in baseball. So it's not exactly as if they have erased the cold start at the plate. It also, you know, the way this week went with a walk-off and then another big extra inning moment, maybe a little too much relying on Isaiah Kiner-Falefa. He's obviously been really, really good for this team, hitting .275, OPSing over .700. He's basically forced his way to where he's in the lineup every day now. I don't mean it as a negative, but it does seem like a lot of big moments are concentrated on a guy who was expected to be like your nine hitter and bouncing around the lineup. I know we talked about it last time you were on, but he keeps kind of forcing our hand here. How big is it for a guy like Isaiah Kiner-Falefa to be the guy coming through? I know he's, you know, vocally been very much about urgency. You know, we've got to stay on it and kind of saying the right things publicly. And then for him to be a new guy who wasn't supposed to be a huge, huge part of the offense to come through in two really big spots in the span of a week here, feels meaningful for them and feels meaningful for him.
Right, for sure. And, you know, he's done what he's been brought in to do in the sense that he's been a contact hitter. You saw him use that skill set against the Orioles, you know, a couple days ago when they won that walk-off. And obviously then, you know, yesterday he's making contact in extra innings. He's the guy that you're kind of happy to see come up in that opportunity. And so that's what he's done his career. I mean, obviously he's had ups and downs. He's not necessarily been known as an offensive player, but he has always been able to put the bat on the ball and make solid contact. And so right now, he seems like he's very comfortable. The Blue Jays have done a good job in that I think they've kind of given him fairly consistent work defensively at places where he's comfortable, you know, second base and third base primarily. Those are positions he knows really well. He's played them, you know, probably the most in his career overall. So that's where he's really comfortable. And I imagine that getting the consistent reps there and just getting consistent at that is only helping him further. And so, you know, good for him for, you know, making the most of this opportunity with the Blue Jays. I know that, you know, the perception out there was that people didn't love the signing. And, you know, you, Blake, have been, you know, talked a lot about it and, you know, what it was worth and all that kind of stuff. But at the same time, like, you just kind of got to tip your cap to him, as John Connor might say, and say that, you know, he's done a good job and he's been what the Blue Jays need him to be and probably a little bit more. You know, the other flip side of that to respond to your question too is that, yes, you're getting a lot from IKF and that's great. You're getting probably more than what you expected from him. But, you know, the flip side of that is that you're still not getting enough from some of your star players that you need. You know, George Springer, Bo Bichette. You know, Vlad has done enough now at this point. I think we can say that Vlad's having a good season, probably a great season, if, you know, even if the power is lacking a little bit. But yes, Justin Turner seems to be turning a corner now. You hope that that continues. But there's still some guys that are not doing enough for you. And yeah, that's when you get into situations where, you know, for a long run, the team is relying on Davis Schneider, who again was supposed to be kind of a complementary piece of this team. He's worked himself into an everyday role. You have IKF now doing a lot, and that's great, but at the same time, like, how long is that going to last? Because he's supposed to be a complimentary piece too. So you take these moments, and if they help you win, that's great. At the same time, usually when teams are having good seasons, great seasons, it's because their best players are having great seasons.
Yeah, and Caitlin, you could just say it. I was wrong about the Isaiah Kiner-Falefa signing so far. I thought 2 years, you know, like, fine as a bench piece, fine as a guy to add. But yeah, I thought 2 years, $15 million was a little on the strong side, given what we saw guys like Ahmed Rosario and other guys kind of in that tier go for. But yeah, so far I have been very wrong on that one. Not that I thought that was the end of the world, but yeah, didn't think he'd end up being kind of an everyday player with, you know, a 715 OPS and worth a win and a half already this season. So happy to be a little inaccurate on that one with Isaiah Kiner-Falefa. Another thing that Jays did to try to juice the offense this weekend is they called up Spencer Horwitz. And we've been waiting for this one for a little bit. There's a lot of talk about who could potentially go down in his place, whether Daniel Vogelbach might get DFA'd, Ernie Clement might get DFA'd. You know, Ernie, you'd probably hope to slide through and outright to AAA, but maybe he would get claimed. If you went that route, it would leave you pretty inflexible positionally off the bench. Ultimately, the team goes with Kevin Biggio instead, which I think caught a lot of us off guard. For anyone who didn't see it, the explanation on the weekend, Kevin Biggio had crossed the 5 years of service time threshold. So even though he had options, once you hit 5 years of service time, you have the right to refuse an option. I'm sure they had those conversations with him. Before we get to the Horwitz side of this, Caitlin, what does it say to you about maybe the urgency this team feels that it was Biggio who has meant a lot in the room? We've heard John Schneider and Ross Atkins and everyone else talk so highly about Kevin Biggio for years. I guess, yeah, were you caught off guard by him being the odd man out? And do you think it, you know, tells us something about this front office, you know, feeling the need to kind of put the more ethereal elements and the more the less production-oriented elements aside as they make decisions the rest of the way?
Yeah, I was caught off guard. I think almost everybody was. I think people that say they were expecting it are probably not being entirely truthful. You know, I think the other options you laid out were the ones that were probably at the forefront of most people's minds who are watching the Blue Jays, just because, you know, Kevin Biggio has been such a, you know, core part of this team for, you know, since 2019, since he came up, since the team was transitioning from, like, one era to the next. And, you know, granted, Kevin was often lumped in with Vlad and Bo, probably because of his last name, but probably because he also had a dad that played in the major leagues. And so it was kind of easy to lump those three together. I think most people that were, you know, really attuned to the Blue Jays sort of knew that he wasn't the level of prospect that they were, but credit to him. He did a really good job in his first couple seasons with the Blue Jays. I think he was, you know, up there as a finalist for Rookie of the Year his first year. You know, he had a good season the following year. He's had his good moments, but obviously just over the last little while hasn't been as consistent, was consistently losing playing time, just wasn't really playing very often because, you know, the Blue Jays were handcuffed. They also became somewhat redundant in that utility player role. They had a lot of guys that did similar things to Biggio. And while he was a really important player for this team, I think his baseball IQ was one of the best on the team. He was a great base runner, always had been a great base runner. He was very useful. He was someone that you like having on the bench, but, you know, unfortunately for him, his position was a bit redundant. The things that he did in terms of, you know, his best attributes at the plate were, you know, his patience. And, you know, sometimes that could hurt him. He would only be too patient sometimes, and his eye would be, you know, almost too good sometimes, where he's taking a lot of pitches and, you know, you're not always getting all those calls. And, you know, the Blue Jays being so desperate for offense, we're willing to keep a bat like Vogelbach, who, you know, recently has been hitting better and just has more potential for power from the left side. So, you know, it seems like Biggio, you just kind of got squeezed out a little bit just because, you know, his skill set wasn't totally what the Blue Jays need, and the things that he were best at was a bit redundant on the roster at this point. You know, it's tough, though. I think that, to your point, it does suggest the Blue Jays are getting to a point where things are very urgent. They're kind of going back on, you know, a lot of things that maybe they relied on in the past. There doesn't seem to be an emphasis on defense, and defense and pitching was all we heard last year. This was a team that they were. Well, you know, now they're at a point where they're playing Vlad at third base, which, you know, he's done a good job at that, but we know that that's not their their best defensive lineup if he's playing third base. So they just seem to be at a point where they've got to do anything and everything to squeeze out as much offense as possible on this team. And, you know, unfortunately in that scenario, Biggio gets squeezed out because they call up Horwitz, who has been having a great AAA season, you know, and maybe offers a little bit more with his bat at the moment. But yeah, it was a pretty shocking move. Obviously you hope for the best for Cavan. I'll just say, like, I always enjoyed covering him. He was a great guy to talk to, just about baseball or life, always very friendly, professional. He really grew as a player too, in just terms of, you know, being really well spoken and being somebody that the other players look to in the clubhouse for just that professionalism and always working, and you're always seeing him, you know, getting him his work day in and day out. So definitely wish him the best. And, you know, hopefully we see him down the road having success with another club.
Yeah, Biggio finishes with the Blue Jays here 47th in franchise history in games played. He got into 490 games. He's also an interesting guy where I think if I were a lesser team, I'd take a flyer on Cavan Biggio. The positional versatility, hey, what if he plays a little bit more regularly? He's a guy who, if you dig into some of the fly ball numbers, there's an interesting case to be made that the alleged change to the balls that killed fly balls leaving the park a little bit hurt him disproportionately, because all of his home runs were like usually wall scrapers. But yeah, I'll be very interested to see what Cavan Biggio looks like in his next stop. The Jays, for anyone who doesn't know, have a couple days here to figure out a trade for him before potentially exposing him to waivers, at which point, you know, every team in the American League in reverse order of standings would have a shot at him. Then he'd go to the NL. Someone would claim him. I think he doesn't make that much money that I think anyone would be too worried about it. Although, the Jays do have a little bit of time here to work out a trade, and you hope that Biggio finds a spot where he can get a little bit more playing time. Yeah, $4.2 million. I think someone would maybe claim that to see what's there with Cavan Biggio. The other side of this, Caitlin, is that it'll get Spencer Horwitz up and in a lineup more. You mentioned the defensive trade-offs they're making. He played second base. You know, perfect so far. We'll see how that continues. A little funny, too, that there were two kind of humorous things about this. One is that, you know, he's not called up because of reasons A, B, and C. And one of those is, you know, presumed, hey, there's still stuff he's working on. And then he's hitting second and first in the lineup. He wasn't good enough to be on the roster on Thursday. He's good enough to be leading off on Sunday. The other thing is narratively, it's very, very tidy that he comes up and in his first game, his first inning back up, is the guy who scores the run that breaks the first inning drought. Obviously, Spencer Horwitz does not do that himself. But what are we looking for here from Horwitz? What is this team asking him to do the next little while?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's just doing a lot of what he did in the minor leagues, and that was, you know, getting on base. It was, you know, he doesn't hit for a ton of power, but there's a little bit of pop in his bat. And I think that, it's all about, again, like the consistency. He sees a lot of pitches, or he was seeing a lot of pitches in the minor leagues. I think it's just looking for that different look, that different type of offense that they can hopefully get from him. You know, I'll be interested to see, obviously a good start for him, like you said, getting in there and doing some things for the team. But, you know, this year in particular has been a tough transition for a lot of guys coming up from the minor leagues on the hitting side. We saw earlier this season the Blue Jays turn to Addison Barger, who was having a great season in AAA himself and, you know, had a tough time in the major leagues. Understandably, that was his first time seeing it. Spencer Horwitz has had a little bit of time in the major leagues, and so he would think that he's probably more ready, just because he's, you know, this isn't his first look at it. So you kind of hope that he can use the experience that he has and kind of, you know, catch up very quickly and be able to make an impact. You know, maybe there's a side of it where he's lifted by the fact that he's back with his roomies, Ernie Clement and Davis Schneider. They're reunited, the Catan gang or whatever you want to call them, are back together. So maybe that is a lift to his spirits, and you know, he feels as comfortable as possible on the Blue Jays and can just make an impact right away.
Yeah, you'd hope so, and yeah, they're reunited there, which is you know, that'll be a fun story to look at here. And like you said, hey, maybe being with the roommates picks Spencer up, but maybe Spencer being up picks the roommates up as well, because Ernie Clement, you know, has kind of lost playing time the last little bit, and Davis Schneider's had a bit of a rough go since moving into that leadoff spot. Caitlin, on the pitching side, we found out before the weekend that Alek Manoah is done for the season officially. We all kind of presumed it based on the updates, but he's going to undergo season-ending elbow surgery on June 17th, so a week from today. We're not sure yet if it would be a Tommy John or that internal brace procedure, but either way, he's done for the year, and he's probably done for a part of 2025 as well, given what we know about recovery timelines. I know you wrote multiple pieces about this for The Athletic. You called it the fifth starter problem with no easy solution. What are we looking at here, both short term, and then, you know, we have to start maybe considering what 2025 looks like even. Obviously, the Jays have a lot of more immediate 2024 work to do, saving this season and getting back in the playoff picture. But if for a rotation that is a little on the older end and could lose Yusei Kikuchi to free agency this offseason, this feels like a pretty big one.
Right, exactly. I mean, about this year, like, the best probably opportunity, obviously Bowden Francis, you know, pitches well yesterday against the A's. That's good to get his confidence up. I think the Blue Jays probably looked at the opportunity against the A's, you know, no offense to them, but just as an opportunity for Bowden to, you know, get experience, hopefully pitch deep into a game. You know, he did those things. And we'll see if he gets the next start or if the Blue Jays go back to using some sort of bullpen day or, you know, using an opener ahead of Bowden. So we'll see what they deploy. Obviously, they'll be playing, you know, a better team. Is it Cleveland that will be? I'm kind of losing track of the schedule. But, yeah, okay. So we'll see. Yariel Rodriguez obviously is another option, too. I think he has maybe potentially one last rehab start coming this week, or rehab outing, and then we'll see if they go to him. Now, he's probably the best option just because, you know, in those limited starts he had at the beginning of the season, he looked pretty good. I mean, he has good stuff, you know, swing and miss stuff for the most part, and so I think that he's probably their most enticing option, but at the same time, you still got to worry about his, you know, his pitch count, his workload. That's something that they seem to be concerned about. So his leash might be kind of short, but, you know, using some combination of him and Bowden Francis, maybe they go forward with something like that. So that's the immediate, but then, yeah, looking down the road a little bit, even to next season, yeah, they could use Kikuchi. You know, now they don't have Manoah probably for the start of the year at the very least. And yeah, there's guys in their system, but not a ton of pitching prospects. Ricky Tiedemann is the one that you think of first, but, you know, he's experienced so many injuries in his recent past. Obviously, he's been injured this year, really hasn't pitched much in AAA, just, you know, a handful of innings. So you need him to get experience before you can even say, like, he's an option for 2025. I mean, presumably he would be, but you kind of just need him to have that experience. And then Adam Macko is another name that's been standing out lately. He's having a good season in AA, probably getting to the point where he's going to earn a promotion to AAA. And then you never really know. Now, I don't know that he's long-term a starting starter per se. I know that maybe I've seen prospect writers write about him having some reliever potential there. He's a lefty, which is useful. So that's someone that they'll probably want to see through, though, and certainly a name that's going to come up this year and next year in terms of starting potential. But, yeah, I mean, looking at free agency, like, they're going to have to – starting pitching is going to be probably a priority for them this year, whether it's bringing Yusei back or getting some other guys to fill out their rotation.
Adam Mackle has looked really good of late. I tried to check out some MILB TV of his last start just to make sure you're not scouting the stat line and stuff. But even he's a guy that, you know, I've gotten asked about him a lot for this year. And right now, he's a guy who only is just getting up to a full starter's pitch count and pitching every fifth day and things like that. So, you know, maybe he is on the 40-man, but maybe he's a little bit away still. And then there's just not that kind of depth at AAA. So there will be lots to sort out there. Caitlin, at least in the interim, this starting rotation has been very good. Over the last month, they are the number two rotation by ERA in baseball behind only the Yankees. They obviously weren't bad to start the year, but it was a little shakier. We've seen Chris Bassitt basically erase the poor start to the season that he had. Kevin Gausman, you know, the ERA is kind of right at four. He's a little bit of, hey, you've dominated bad teams and been shaky against good teams, but he's mostly where you need him to be. And then, like you mentioned, Bowden Francis with a nice bounce back on Sunday. Obviously, we'd all like a little bit more offense from this team, but this is kind of the formula if they can make it work. It's all feeling very much like last year with those four starters carrying a big load and then just kind of crossing their fingers that the bullpen days will work and they'll get just enough offense at the right time. But I guess this is it for the next couple weeks at least, right?
Right. And, you know, that's probably something that the front office should have been better prepared for. I think, like, when you talk about, you know, the fifth starter problem that they have, it is really no different than last year, although we've gotten to that. We've gotten to this place via a different route this year. But the Blue Jays should have been able to anticipate that Manoah was coming into the season with a lot of question marks. And so, no, they couldn't necessarily have anticipated him getting injured and getting, you know, dramatically injured, obviously needing Tommy John or a various other elbow surgery with the brace. But, you know, they also should have kind of been prepared for the fact that, you know, maybe he didn't bounce back. Maybe he had enough rough season. Maybe he wasn't able to be the guy that he was in the past. And I think that they probably didn't build up enough starting pitching depth. Yariel Rodriguez and Bowden Francis are basically the two guys that they can turn to, and I think both of them came with significant questions too. Yariel's coming from, you know, a past where he's only pitched in Cuba and Japan, doesn't have major league experience, didn't pitch last season, so he's going to come with a huge amount of questions in terms of his workload. You're going to have to be careful with him. You know, Bowden Francis, also a guy that they haven't really used as a starter much before, kind of moved him into the bullpen last year where he did pitch really well. But, you know, I think there were still kind of questions about what he can do as a starter. And so the Blue Jays just seemed to be caught flat-footed when it came to solving this fifth starter problem. And I don't think they should have been. I think it's something that they could have definitely foreseen just in the fact that, you know, this rotation is, yes, has a long track record of being good when you're talking about those four top guys. But I think there was kind of an obvious place in the rotation where things could have gone wrong. And it's really unfortunate the way it's gone wrong for Manoah. But I think when you're just talking about the front office, I think they should have been more prepared for this. And, you know, the starting pitching depth is just, it's just not deep enough. You know, they just don't have a ton of guys that can step into a major league rotation, just kind of, you know, carry them.
Yeah, apologies if I don't consider Wes Parsons and Paolo Espino to be, you know, good starting pitching depth to start the season. If I didn't bite on that pump fake, even though I thought Mitch White would maybe stick in a bullpen role. Caitlin McGrath, thank you so much for taking the time out this morning. I really appreciate it. See you down at the park later this week.
Sounds good. Thank you.
Caitlin McGrath of The Athletic. Make sure you're checking out all her great work over there. Some good breakdowns of the Alek Manoah situation, what this looks like for Manoah and for the Blue Jays in the short and medium term. And again, yeah, you obviously everyone's very, very focused on this season and the triage mode of how do you cobble together a fifth starter right now. Right now, that looks like Bowden Francis plus extended bullpen appearances. But yeah, there's a 2025 question mark as well. So to refresh you on those notes, Manoah is done for the season. Tommy John or internal brace surgery, that'll happen next Monday. Yariel Rodriguez is supposed to make another rehab outing tomorrow for AAA Buffalo. They're hoping to get him up to 70 pitches. He threw in his last one 43 pitches plus 15 in the bullpen afterwards. If he was up to 70 pitches after this outing, presumably he'd be ready to go to contribute at least multiple innings at the major league level. Ricky Tiedemann threw two innings of live BP on Friday. The next step for him is getting into a rehab start for the Florida Complex League or Single A Dunedin. Jordan Romano was expected to throw off flat ground yesterday or today. He received an anti-inflammatory injection last weekend. He's going to have to build up to throwing from 150 feet on flat ground before he returns to the mound. Two other small updates. Nathan Lucas left Buffalo's game on the weekend with a thumb injury. So if you're looking at potential outfield depth, especially on a team now where you don't have Kevin Biggio, because he is presumably the backup right fielder to this point, Nathan Lucas is, we await an update on Nathan Lucas's thumb. For now, Dalton Varsho is the guy who's going to fill in right field when George Springer needs a day off or is a designated hitter for the day. We saw that on the weekend. Dalton Varsho's career defensive metrics in right field, just as good as they are in center and left. So not plan A for how you set up your outfield defense, but not a terrible outcome necessarily. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll get to know this Brewers team that the Blue Jays now face and try to take another 2 of 3 off of to get back to 500. We'll be joined by Tim Dillard, former Brewers pitcher, holder of many minor league pitching records, and Brewers analyst. That's next as Jays Talk Plus continues on the Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360.
Dive deep into Toronto sports and the NFL. The JD Bunkus Podcast. Subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy. That song is one of many you may have seen our next guest lip-syncing over the years, especially if you were on baseball Twitter and circa, 2017 to 2019 or so. Tim Dillard is a Brewers analyst at Bally Sports Wisconsin and a former Brewers pitcher, host of Brewers Unfiltered. We're going to have him on momentarily here. We're good. We're good to go. Tim, what's up, man? How are you?
I'm good. Yeah, sorry, I'm struggling. I was trying to make the computer look better so I didn't look as old, but apparently it's not the computer or the camera.
Well, I got the same issue in studio here, so don't worry about it that much. I got a couple in the beard here as well, so yeah, we're all good, man.
I try to rip those out, man. You see a couple in there, you're like, get out of my beard. But yeah, it's inevitable.
It is inevitable. It's too many. Thanks for doing this, Tim. Before we talk baseball, I know it didn't go the way that you were hoping, but Milwaukee Admirals game 5 on Saturday, I know you've gotten behind that AHL team, came up short trying to punch a ticket to the Calder Cup. But how was that game? How's your experience been as a big Admirals fan?
Yeah, I mean, when I'm here in Milwaukee, I live in Nashville. So when I'm here and the Brewers aren't playing, man, I just got time to myself. And so I just gravitated towards the Admirals games and they give me free tickets. So I'm going to keep showing up. And they kept winning. So they kept going to each round. And the games were really exciting. They almost were eliminated maybe in 6 or 7 different games, and they kept winning. But they couldn't pull it out the other night. Actually, I had my family with me, and everybody that was sitting in the section pretty much knew who I was. So it was pretty cool. It was pretty cool. Everybody's cheering together and high-fiving, but it wasn't enough. But the Admirals had a good shot, and they have another year coming next year.
All right. Well, yeah. Sorry, it didn't work out for you. Glad you're having some fun with it there. Love minor league hockey. Yeah. Look, man, I know you said you live in Nashville. I know you're from Florida originally. But it does feel from afar like you're very attached to Milwaukee. I know you spent a long time in that Brewers organization. When your playing career is done, you go back to that organization. They even drafted you 2 different times. What is it about the way things have played out, you think, that have attached you so much to the city of Milwaukee and this Brewers org?
Yeah, I have no idea. I'm just thankful that they saw something in me years ago. Listen, I think every young player thinks that one day they're going to be like, oh, I want to play for this team. Like, you have no control over that. The Brewers drafted me as a catcher in 2001. So our relationship started when I was still in high school. And I didn't end up signing. I actually had an injury. And so they signed me the next year as a catcher. And then they end up signing me the next year in 2003 as a pitcher, because they were like, hey, we think you'll have a longer career as a pitcher. And I didn't believe them at the time, but I did pitch for 18 seasons. I think 16 of those were with parts of the Brewers organization. And they asked me to retire and coach maybe like 4 or 5 times. And then they came right before 2021 spring training. I was going to go back to spring training with the Rangers. And they said, hey, if you'll retire, we'll put you on the broadcast team. And my wife said, yes. She was sick of the minor league life. I had pitched probably 16 full seasons in the minor league. She was like, let's just call it a career and start something new. And I didn't know if I could do broadcasting or not, but it's gotten me this far. And I don't know. Baseball is really fun. I still feel attached to it, doing the broadcast. I get to see the guys on the planes and on the buses. And, you know, and I kind of know what they're going through. Baseball's a hard game, but it's also a kind of a hard life as well.
And you mentioned the career in the minor leagues, and obviously you hold a lot of records with the Nashville Sounds. I know you live in Nashville. You've had your jersey retired by them. So it's not a huge surprise that you've been drawn to the Milwaukee Admirals, by the way, the local minor league team in that regard. So your transition to media, obviously, you know, you said it, you've had offers to coach at a couple different times. I think that probably says a lot about what organizations and other teammates have thought of you. You know, I remember Chris Woodward saying he wanted you in Texas. Originally, this was still as a player, but because of that kind of mentorship, but you've chosen media instead. You were always like before everyone was, you were kind of very social media forward, right? Like TikTok before there was TikTok, just showing a lot more of your personality. Do you think that's part of what's made you a pretty natural fit for media? Just you were always kind of comfortable putting yourself out there?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, back in the day when I was growing up, me and my brothers, you know, back when you had to tether the VCR to the camera so you can see yourself on the TV. Hey, I'm still not over that. I'm doing it right now on Zoom. Hey, I can see myself. Yeah, and then I was with the Brewers for so long that I was in AAA, and a lot of time I was inactive. So I'm like, I got to come up with something to do. So I started shooting these videos with my teammates in the clubhouse, which I'm going to be honest with you, it's a no-no. You know, you don't film or reveal anything that goes on in the clubhouse. But the Brewers, I think, and I asked them too. I asked several coaches, and then I got to talk to, you know, some of the coordinators and then even higher ups. They said they trusted me. They're like, we've known you. We know your character. We know who you are. We think you're going to make the organization and the players look good out of this. You're not going to post anything bad. And I haven't and won't ever. And so I made these videos with guys in the clubhouse just showing us having a good time, and turned out to be a pretty big thing on Twitter and Instagram. And I think Facebook every once in a while. If I can remember all my login information. But yeah, it really, what it did is just killed time for us because we have a lot of downtime, especially in the minor leagues. But what you get to see is some guys have some good talents, good actors. I got Josh Hader. If you know who Josh Hader is, he was in a lot of my videos. Great actor. You know, people think of him as a pitcher. You know, he throws upper 90s and saves games, but I know him as an actor. But what it really was fun is, like, if you put a Lego set together with somebody, you know, or if you go and build something with somebody, you kind of have that moment. It's more about what you're doing together rather than the finished product. And that's what I got out of it. And I think teammates did as well, because I'll still get texts from teammates all the time. Be like, hey, I'm in whatever city. Remember that video we shot? And I'm telling you, it kind of showed behind the scenes, like a documentary of our seasons, really is what it came down to.
Yeah, it was very cool. And it's something that, you know, we've seen teams try to capture since then. I don't know if you can capture it the same when it's not the players themselves doing it.
Hard to do it. Yep.
Yeah. So let's talk about this Brewers team that you are covering now. They are 38-27. They are very, very good. And heading into this year, there were a lot of questions about if they'd have enough pitching. Corbin Burns got dealt. Brandon Woodruff was hurt. You know, I know they've only been like middle of the pack in terms of starting pitching ERA, but the bullpen's been really good. They've gotten some, you know, maybe more contribution from a Colin Ray or a Tobias Myers than maybe expected. How have they been able to, you know, I'll say cobble it together, given how many, and I didn't even list all the pitching injuries. There's been a lot here. DL Hall, Joe Ryan. How have they been able to get this done with how thinned out the starting rotation has been on paper?
Honestly, if you ask them, they probably don't know. But what it comes down to is just a series of unfortunate events. They went and got a bunch of starters. I always think back to Oral Hershiser. He, you know, obviously one of the best pitchers ever, but also one of the best broadcasters ever. And one of the things that he always talks about is, when you're coming out of spring training, it's not who are my five or six starters. It's you need eight starters. So the Brewers did right. They went out and got a whole bunch of starters. They put them all in spring training, and then the guys just kept falling by the wayside. Of course, they lost Brandon Woodruff for the year, but then Wade Miley gets hurt, Joe Ross. Then all of a sudden, you got to start calling guys up. Jacob Junis gets hurt. And you're like, okay, well, what's going to happen here? DL Hall throws a couple of starts, and then he's on the IL, and you're going, what is happening? And then it falls on the bullpen. I've been in the bullpen a lot, and listen, when it falls on you, you got to step up. And they put together a pretty outstanding bullpen. And the reason you know this is they've thrown more innings than anyone in baseball, the bullpen. They have more wins out of the bullpen than anybody, and you're getting quality innings. I got to highlight Jared Koenig and Brian Hudson. Those guys, the two left-handed condors, they swoop in. Thank goodness they migrated to Milwaukee because they've been great. Multiple innings. And this is a team that for years only had maybe one guy or two guys that would go multiple innings. Now they're looking for everybody to be able to go multiple innings. Because back in the day, you think Craig Counsell when he was there, you got 7, 8, 9 guys. That was it. Starters get you there, and then it's 7, 8, 9, and everybody has a role. Right now there's maybe one role when it comes to Trevor McGill being the closer, but aside from that, it's all hands on deck every single game. So the starting pitching, it's they're patching it together, but the bullpen's what's kept this team afloat.
Yeah, Trevor McGill, by the way, should be off playing power forward for the Milwaukee Bucks. I don't need to see a pitcher that big on the mound.
He's intense, man. Throws 100, and he's got a knuckle curve coming out of that. Like you, and if it's in the zone, like there's not much you can do. Like you just have to guess and hope that if it hits your bat, it doesn't break it and maybe lands where no one's standing. So the odds are in his favor.
Yeah, I'd imagine it's just like obviously the velocity is the velocity. But when a guy's like 6'8", 6'9", 250, 260 coming down the hill at you as well.
The curveball's coming from the top of the Jumbotron, right? What are you going to do?
You mentioned Craig Counsell there. Obviously, that was a bit of a dramatic part of the offseason here. We've seen Pat Murphy manage differently. And maybe some of that's necessity with what's happened to the rotation. But what kind of difference have you noticed? What have you liked about the way Pat Murphy has handled this season for the Brewers?
Well, one thing that Pat Murphy does really well is he's very transparent. He's very honest. He gives you a you ask a question, gives you a straight answer. Not in a mean way, but in a probably more revealing way than I've seen any manager. And they ask, hey, why'd you go to this guy in the seventh inning? He'll give you a list. Well, the reason we did this is because of this. You don't have to guess anymore. Like, he's made my job easier as a broadcaster because I'll say something like, I bet he did this because of this. And then he'll literally say this in the postgame show. Well, I did this because of this. And I look smart. I'm like, well, yay. That's something that Counsell would never do. He kept everything close to the chest, which, you know, that's his style. But for Pat Murphy, I mean, he's an open book. The team is winning because he wants fundamentally sound players, well-rounded players. I mean, they're up there in walks. They're up there in stolen bases. They just fell out of the top 10 in home runs just because they've played at some tough places. But it's just a very well-rounded ball club. And I'm telling you, the defense is pretty amazing too. I mean, I think they're second in baseball and outs above average. So they're doing everything very well. And that's the reason that they're winning. And one of the big things too is they like to bunt. And people call it small ball. I don't think that's correct. I think it's called playing baseball. They're hitting behind runners at times. They're getting their sac flies, and they're getting better as each month goes by. And they had a trouble getting a guy in from third base in Philadelphia, and they completely revamped and got that done in Detroit. So what I'm seeing is a team that's continually getting better, and they already have a great record.
Yeah, I like the bunt aspect. Obviously, analytically, like the sack bunt is very situational, but they don't do that a lot. They're trying to bunt for hits. They're trying to bunt the board, and they're so fast, right? This is like up and dead. Like obviously Bryce Terang is the stolen base leader on this team and the leadoff guy, but pretty much everyone has 3, 4, 5 stolen bases.
Well, I think it's teaching these guys situational awareness. And they have the youngest lineup in all of baseball. They got Jackson Churio. He's 20 years old. And when you see him opening day hitting a ball behind a runner, I mean, you're like, what in the world? Like, this doesn't happen. And if you're living dying by the home run, guess what? You will live or you will die by the home run. But if you can beat guys in different ways, make the pitcher uncomfortable. That's exactly what they do. They get into the bullpen early, earlier than most teams, and then they just wreak havoc on the bullpen relievers' ERAs. I've seen it over and over and over again. They put pressure on the base paths. But Pat Murphy says, you know what, maybe they didn't do this in the past because they didn't have the personnel to be able to do it. Blake Perkins can steal bases, Joey Ortiz. These guys can lay down bunts. These guys can swing for power. And they can play, you know, elite defense at their position. So, I mean, they're maybe not the most household names out there, but you do know who Christian Yelich is, and he's living up to the hype. He's having an incredible season. William Contreras probably going to win another Silver Slugger. He's going to be an all-star. The Brewers are good, and they're good with guys that have finally gotten their shot.
You think Contreras is, like, obviously when I'm doing a show in Toronto or you're doing the Milwaukee thing, we're always, like, centered on the team that we're doing, but William Contreras, in terms of guys who probably aren't as popular, as well known as they should be given the talent level, like we're talking about a good defensive catcher who hits the ball crazy hard consistently, doesn't strike out a ton, can steal a couple bases. Like, do you think he's among probably the more underrated players in baseball?
Yeah, I mean, this is a stigma that the Brewers have. Like, they're just not a popular team for some reason, but they are in Wisconsin. And we get viewership through the roof because people love their team. They're smart fans. They know what smart, good baseball looks like. But if you go around the rest of the country, you know, there's Cubs fans everywhere. There's Yankee fans everywhere, Red Sox fans. And I just don't think they get as, you know, popular when it comes to some of that stuff. But they're a good ball club. And Wim Contreras is a part of that, big part of that. In fact, I mean, you could even go and say, okay, he hits the ball harder than anybody. They're inventing stats for this guy, like squared up percentage. You know, we should just call it a ball well struck. Huzzah! You know, this guy's crushing the baseball. But what I love about him is, I don't know what time it is where you are, about 10:50?
Yeah.
In about 4 hours, I'm going to head to the ballpark, and I'm going to watch him take early batting practice because that's what he does every single day when they're at home at American Family Field. He'll do it on the road as well, and he works on hitting the ball where people are not standing. And that's what he works on. He says he can't get that in the cage. So he wants to see the flight of the balls that he's absolutely mashing. So he's hitting balls that don't even have to be in the zone. If you watch him over probably a series, you'll get to see him square up a ball that's not in the zone. Probably not even in a two-strike count, but he knows he can hit it. So here's a situation, guys, on second base. Maybe there's one out. Pitcher throws a slider down and away. Instead of pulling it, rolling over to third base and getting out, he'll keep his hands back. He has kind of an awkward swing. And then just hits a missile to the right side for a single. I mean, he's done it in almost every single ball game. It's reminiscent of Ryan Braun. If Ryan Braun gets out in his first at bat, you can better believe he's going to see a pitch away and he's just going to hit it to the right side just to get his knocks in. And then a pitcher makes a mistake late in the ball game thinking he's only going to go opposite field. And then boom, that's where he gets his extra base hits.
Setting up a guy over the course of the game, over the course of the series, over the course of the season. It's cool to see. And yeah, I get what you're saying. I'm surprised that the Brewers have never been more like culturally popular. Like I've always had an affinity for them. I think partially because of Mr. 3000, the Bernie Mac movie. You know, Eric Thames was one of my favorite guys in Toronto, and then he ended up back on Milwaukee after his stint in the KBO. Is it true that you dressed up as a limo driver to pick him up from the airport when the Brewers first got him?
Yeah, how'd you hear about that?
I remember hearing it, and I was trying to like Google it to find it, yeah. And I couldn't find it, and I was like, don't ask this, because if you're wrong, you'll seem like an idiot, but I thought I would do it anyway.
Yeah, I'm kidding. I'm lying. I've never heard of this. You do sound like it. No, I'm kidding. It was so... the Brewers wanted me to do something for their fan fest. And so I came up with the idea of going, well, who's on the team that I've never heard of? And it was Travis Shaw and Eric Thames. Not that I haven't heard of them, but I knew they didn't know who I was. So I got the idea is like, I'll just pick them up and pretend I'm a limo driver. I mean, I've always wanted to do that anyway, ever since Dumb and Dumber. So I went and got like the shades, and I got like one of those little hats from Party City, and I got those fingerless gloves because I'm a serious limo driver. And anyway, we set up like a GoPro. I was just going to set my phone up. They were like, no, we're going to set up a GoPro. They mic'd up the car. And the first time we did it, it didn't work. We have no video. I think we have some audio out there. And I pick up Eric Thames, and he was the first one. And I thought we had a good ride. Didn't work. The second time we did it with Travis Shaw, it did work. So it was pretty funny. Like in the middle of the drive, I just pull over at a bar and I ran in. And I'm like, hold on, I got to pay my tab. And they're like looking like, what in the world? But with Eric, what was really cool is since he played in Korea, I had a line of questioning that I knew would get him to baseball. So I had already memorized these lines. I knew exactly what I was going to do. He gets in the car. I'm talking to him. I'm like, hey, you from Milwaukee? He's like, yeah. And you know Eric Thames. I mean, big beard, big muscles. And anyway, I finally got him to be like, well, what are you doing here? He said, well, I'm coming to the fan fest. I'm like, oh, you're a baseball player. He's like, yeah. And I was like, I went to some games last year. I was like, maybe I saw you play. He's like, no, I played in Korea. And I turn around. I'm like, you're Korean? And he's like, what? No. And I memorized a line in Korea. It was something like, I can't remember all the words, but it said something like, smile, you're on video. And he's like, no, man, I don't speak Korean. I'm like, okay. Anyway, we had a great time. Never told him it was a gag. About 2 days later, I see him at the team hotel on the elevator getting off. And it was an awkward exchange. But every time I've seen him since, he always just starts laughing because we have a moment that nobody can find on the internet that is pretty one of the funniest moments of my life.
That's great. Apparently, he's going to be at this series. So if you see him, tell him he needs to come on as well and tell his side of the story. What he was thinking as you run into the bar at the limo.
He's probably thinking, I need to get out of here. I mean, Uber wasn't big back then. I mean, yeah. This is kind of what they would do. Hey, we're going to send someone to the airport, pick you up.
Oh, man. All right. Tim Dillard, thanks so much, man. Really appreciate you taking the time out this morning. Enjoy the series.
Yep. Thanks.
Tim Dillard, Brewers analyst at Bally Sports Wisconsin, former Brewers pitcher, host of Brewers Unfiltered. And yeah, if you're in Milwaukee, there's even a Dim Tillard Captain Cliche IPA from Broken Bat Brewing. So lots to like about Tim Dillard. Lots to like about this Brewers team. We'll continue to set the series up for you in the second half of the show. Colin Ray's on the hill tonight. The big thing to look for him, he does have a 3.53 ERA. Almost no pitcher in baseball has a bigger gap between their actual ERA and their expected ERA based on swing and miss and quality of contact and thing like that. Does that mean regression is coming his way? Does it mean the trickery of being able to throw six different pitches just keeps guys off balance so well? We'll dig into that a little bit more, help you get to know this Brewers team more. When we come back, we'll talk to Caleb Joseph about the series that was and continue to set up this Brewers one. We'll also talk to Ashley Stevenson, Vancouver Canadiens coach, and as of this coming weekend, Canadian Baseball Hall of Famer. She's being inducted along with Russell Martin and Jimmy Key and some others. That's all next as Jays Talk Plus continues.
Big guests and bigger opinions on everything happening in Leafsland. Real Kipper and Bourne. Be sure to subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy. Jays managed to take 2 of 3 against Oakland on the weekend. They get back to within one game of 500. They seem to keep nudging up against it. But hey, at least they jumped to fourth in the American League East and somehow are only 2 games out of the wild card, even though it's felt like for 2 months and change we've been talking about them underperforming. Let's see how Caleb Joseph feels about it. He's been on Blue Jays Central for the last series. Caleb, what's up, man? How we doing?
Hey, what's up, Blake? Good morning.
Good morning. I guess let's start with a guy you know well. You ever seen Yusei Kikuchi truck someone like that?
No, that was pretty unbelievable. Of course, he's trying to get out of the way, and most pitchers do not have that type of reaction, that quick-natured reaction that he has. And it's just too bad that he ran right into the first baseman. But no, I've never seen anything like that before. I think Dan Shulman alluded to something similar. And how fitting for a play like that in the Toronto Blue Jays last game in Oakland.
Certainly. Did you have any like very Oakland experiences when you were in Oakland Coliseum over the years?
Yeah, I remember the Seagulls coming out after getting into extra innings. And I thought that was very weird. The very first time that I ever played there, we went into extra innings and I had no idea what that was. I looked up and had to ask an experienced teammate what in the world this is. And he told me, no, they have internal clocks and they know when the game starts and they know when it should be over. And so should be over. They're ready for their afternoon snack. That was pretty unique. And, you know, you have to walk through the stands to get through to the clubhouse. And it's a very, very unique setup where you're literally walking in a very narrow hallway with fans. And there's a tiny little rope that would separate you and the fans. And so just a very unique setup. Makes you think of some of the low A ball and double A ball stadiums that you would play in, where you'd be super close and interactive with the fans. But it is weird that is the last game that Toronto will play there. This ordeal has been going on for so long that it just kind of doesn't really seem real. Like something happens, they'll be back next year. It's no big deal. But that's it. It is almost a foregone.
Caleb, we're going to have to reconnect with you here just for a second. We're getting some clipping on your end. We'll reconnect with you and bring you right back. Caleb Joseph will rejoin us in a second here. Again, yeah, it is the last time the Blue Jays will play in Oakland because, of course, that team is being hijacked by John Fisher and taken to a minor league ballpark in Sacramento for 3 years and then eventually to Vegas, although that is still up in the air as well because they're pushing to play neutral site games and the money is not as clear as maybe they had anticipated. I believe Nevada voting on some of that this week, or at least discussing it further. So yeah, it remains a mess there. The Jays did come up with the win yesterday. When we talked to Caleb Joseph on the show 2 weeks ago. It was coming off of that tough Tiger series, and we kind of asked him, hey, what do the Jays need to do from here? That was maybe the low point of the season. You dropped 3 or 4 to the Tigers, and Caleb told us, hey, every guy individually, like, it's great to stay together as a team, but every guy individually has to kind of look in the mirror. What can I be doing better? How can I, do my part better to pull this team out of it? In the time since that conversation, Caleb, the Jays have gone 9-4. It has been weaker competition. Yes, they swept the White Sox. They beat Pittsburgh and Oakland 2-1 each. They split 4 with Baltimore. When you think back to that Monday coming out of that Detroit series, have you seen enough of what you were talking about that Monday with us over the last 2 weeks? Like, are you seeing what you had hoped for from this Blue Jays team?
Yeah, definitely seeing what I'm hoping to see. Is it enough? I'm not quite there yet, to be honest with you. But making inches and stepping forward is, I guess, the best thing that I'm looking for, is just incremental steps forward, even if it's 1%. That is what I'm looking for with the offense especially. And I thought that there were multiple times in the Oakland series where guys really stepped up and kind of did what they needed to do, especially Isaiah Kiner-Falefa in yesterday's game. Sometimes you, as a player, you have to be the guy, and you got to look at the situation and you got to put the team on your back and just kind of carry it to the finish line. Isaiah Kiner-Falefa with 5 runs batted in yesterday, 2 really, really nice situational hitting opportunities presented themselves to him, and he was able to just get it done. And they did a lot of little things in that series that I really liked that propelled them to be able to score runs, whether it was taking a bag, being aggressive on the base pass, having good approaches, not giving in certain situations. I thought offensively that was a really nice step forward for the Jays.
So this is the Jays are in a spot now where, even though it's felt pretty negative for most of the season, they're only 2 games out of a playoff spot. They've crawled back almost to .500. The American League is, pretty open in that regard. And I know that you've been on some teams where in the older format, things could get really close, really down to the wire. And I know you were on that Jays team in 2020 where the format was expanded. You were around that Mariners team that came up just short in 2021. How much has the expanded format, changed how you feel about, like, hey, this team hasn't played that well, but, like, they're always, like, this Jays team is close enough, even if we don't love the way they've played. How much have you had to change kind of your interpretation of, the 162 grind, given that there are these extra spots now?
Oh, yeah. It changes everything. I think Dan Shulman made a great point that there's 100-something games left. I mean, that's a lot of baseball games. And you get to the point where you can't panic, and you've got to realize that it is a marathon. And with the added teams, there are so many teams that at this point in the season would already be self-declaring, maybe even if it's internally only, that they are going to be selling at the deadline. And it's miraculous how just those extra spots have really given so many teams at this spot that the Jays are in huge hope to go for it. And the fan base would go nuts if they ended up selling and the trade deadline was right now and they were 2 games out of a playoff spot, right? They would be irate. So it brings so many more teams in, which I enjoy. I enjoy having the competitive season for longer than, quote, normal, when more teams are out and then they start calling up prospects. And I think it's good for baseball, but it does put general managers and executives in a weird spot, because you're so close. You're not only trying to figure out how you add, but how much you add and at what cost, depending on your chances of thinking how the team is going to perform. If you think this team can actually win a World Series, how much of the farm system are you willing to mortgage, and who are you willing to trade, and blah, blah, blah. But this is where it gets really tricky, is this Jays team is just kind of hovering and limping. And until they really get a huge push forward, I would think that management would be really cautious, knowing that making the playoffs is the goal, because anything can happen. But are you willing to maybe trade some top prospects, or Elvis Martinez or Ricky Tiedemann, et cetera, to go really, really get it done? So it'll be interesting to see how the rest of the next 4 to 6 weeks really shakes out. But if they keep inching forward, I absolutely believe that they'll have to add. They won't be in a position where they'll do anything but add and really give a go at it.
So how they got to this point, the weekend was pretty dramatic. There was the one pitch walk-off on Friday and then a couple of really good pitching outings. Bowden Francis yesterday looked much better than we'd seen him in his previous outings, whether out of the bullpen or as a starter early in the season. I know it is the Oakland Athletics lineup. It is not the same as, you know, the New York Yankees or the Baltimore Orioles lineup. But Caleb, what did you like from Bowden Francis, maybe particularly with that slider and the way he executed it yesterday?
Yeah, that was it was a really tight pitch. I liked the spin and the downward depth on it. I'm a real big fan of his curveball as well. I think that could be probably for me the number one pitch if he could just continue to rev it and get out there. Like the split finger, that was actually a bit of a surprise. There were a couple that didn't do, I think, what he wanted it to do, but I did see a couple with some really nice action. So of course he's trying to continue to add to his repertoire, and that's what you should do. And especially with the veteran pitchers that he has around them, having those conversations with your Bassetts, your Gausmans, even Kikuchi. I like what he brings. I really would like to see him pitch externally to that 6'5" giant human that he is. I think he should get a little bit angry out there. I'd like to see him bully some guys. I know everybody likes his fastball at the top. I would like to see him using more the inner and outer lanes versus so much the top part of the zone. I think to be as effective as he wants to be, he's going to have to really bully some guys inside, establish the outer half as well. I'd like him working more east and west than north-south with the fastball. But that slider was good. Like I was actually shocked at how hard the spin looked and the late action on it. That was surprising. I didn't really see that coming in this start, but he showed it and he flashed it, and that's what you're looking for. You're looking for the flash of, okay, it's there. We've seen it. Now can you repeat it, and can you get that same action 8 out of 10 sliders that you throw?
Caleb, you mentioned Bowden Francis, a splitter there. That's a newer pitch. He's only thrown like 30 of them in the majors this year. He was throwing it a bunch in AAA on his rehab assignment. He had walked me through the other day some of the different grips he had to go through to try to find the right one for him. If you're calling the game for him back there and you know he's going to face some of these guys a second time, but he's almost certainly not seeing the order a third time, et cetera. How often are you going to that splitter as a fourth pitch with him, especially as he kind of is still working out the feel for it right now?
Yeah, that's always the challenge, is trying to figure out how to make a pitch better without costing him and the outing and your team the outing. And you're always looking for positions where you feel like you have protection. You feel like you can throw a pitch, and maybe because of the previous two or three pitches before that, you've created some room for error so that if he doesn't throw his best splitter, you're not looking at a two-run homer or a double off the wall. So I like to kind of target the guys in the lineup that I think is a good matchup where they would traditionally have low numbers on splits. And then based off of the inning, based off of pitch count, based off of the score, all of those things, you're just making it work in terms of trying to use other pitches to get a guy. You've got that split in your mind when the batter comes up and you're thinking, okay, let me try and create some room for error. Let's go slider away, get him looking out, and then we'll go double up inside with some two, try and get it up and in. And if he can really get it up and in, then I'm going to try and drop a split right underneath because it might tunnel off that same on that same spot. And then I'm giving him like a really nice target, really emphasizing where I want, and just trying to give him his confidence. The visual to have him feel that confidence and be able to execute the pitch. But you can't get beat by that third and fourth pitch, especially with a guy like Francis, who just is really trying to continue to gain some momentum and establish himself as the possible fifth guy. while Alec Manoah is out.
Yeah, and look, a good step forward there. Four innings, three hits, a walk, and three strikeouts. And then, you know, Trevor Richards had a blip out of the bullpen, but mostly the bullpen kind of carries it from there. At one point, it looked like that Trevor Richards blip was maybe going to, you know, the Jays couldn't add any insurance runs off of Mitch Spence after their initial two. We get to the eighth inning, Dalton Varsho singles, and something we don't see the Jays do a ton, especially with a runner on first, is Isaiah Kiner-Falefa, who you mentioned had obviously had that big moment in the 10th, bunts Varsho over to second, and we didn't know it at the time, but Varsho steals third, and that would be probably the most pivotal 90 feet of the game, because Davis Schneider then puts one far enough for him to score as a sac fly. Probably wouldn't have scored, or I mean, he would have moved up from second, but who knows what would have happened from there. What did you make of that Varsho steal of third in real time, and man, how heady a play is that in retrospect?
Yeah, it was huge, and it just shows you kind of the high baseball IQ level that Varsho has. As soon as he got onto first base, you could see first base coach Mark Budzinski talking to him. And at that point, he's given him some times. He's given him probably what is going to be happening, which is a bunt. But I can almost guarantee you that he is knowing that IKF is about to bunt him over. And so Budzinski's probably in his ear saying, hey, Varsh, if you want IKF bunts you over, you're going to be at second base. He's a one-look guy. He's a two-look guy. He's a no-look. He's given him kind of the report, and pitchers have tendencies. And that's what you're always looking to grab and find is pitcher tendencies when it comes to looks at second base. You're the runner at second base. You can know that. And you can use that to your advantage. It's exactly what Varsho did. Got to second base, realized that the left-hander was a one-look and then go guy, and they had a great shot of it behind home plate where as soon as the lefty looked at Varsho, by the time his head was moving back towards the catcher, Varsho absolutely knew that he was only going home, and you could see him double shuffle and then just took off. And that was huge because that allowed Schneider, who's a really good, in my opinion, he's a really good kind of deep fly ball guy. It's probably like his natural path and natural out is that deep fly ball. And that set the whole game up. If they don't get that run, you're talking about us having a conversation about the Jays going backwards, especially after they kind of blow the lead in Friday's game, loses by walk-off fashion. It's we're talking totally different. These games are absolutely huge, and it's those little plays, those little kind of high risk, high reward, but risk taken because of really good knowledge and really good execution that really kind of won them that game, in my opinion.
Yeah, and it's you know, it's huge. And yeah, I don't want to imagine what this conversation would have been like had they dropped that one. Davis Schneider gets that sac fly, and I know that he popped out in the 10th in what was a little bit of a rally there. But when you're a guy like Davis Schneider, you're in that situation, you know, you're down for the day, you're coming off of a week and really like a 2-week stretch where you haven't been hitting the ball as well as you normally do, still drawing some walks and things like that, but the hits haven't been coming, the extra base hits haven't been coming. Can something like that, coming off the bench and just doing a job, can that get you moving back in the right direction?
Oh, absolutely, especially in Oakland. One of the things I will not miss about that ballpark was the fact that there is no cages. The cages are in center field, and so that's why you get a lot of TV shots of guys walking across the field with bats in their hands. There is one tiny little cage, and it is literally in center field. The only way to get there is to walk across the field. So as a player, you're literally in the dugout or in the clubhouse, and you have no way. Like, you're hitting off of one of those little tees with a little net right in front of it, like as little league as possible, and you have no idea where the ball's going. You're just kind of taking dry hacks for the most part, and then you're in the game. So it's very unusual in terms of not having that cage, how guys prepare. That your prep and your routine totally different when you're coming off the bench as a pinch hitter in Oakland because of the lack of facilities. So to be able to come off the bench and put such a good swing on a decent pitch in an incredibly pivotal moment will give David Schneider tons of enthusiasm and confidence, knowing, man, that was like, you come off the bench and you get it done. There's no greater feeling knowing personally you did it, but for your team, and it's just clutch. And I know it's hard to kind of quote quantify that, but I think those type of at-bats can really take you a long way mentally, even though he didn't get a hit. You just know you got it done for your ball club. That's a great feeling.
I mean, like we just said, right? You don't even necessarily need to try to quantify it, because if he doesn't come up in that spot, if him and Varsho and IKF don't tag team for that run, they don't have a chance to win it in extras. We're talking about a very different mood and a very different spot in the standings and things like that today. So I'm sure he feels that. He also got his roommate back this weekend. Spencer Horwitz got the call. Kevin Biggio, It caught me off guard. It seemed to catch people off guard on Twitter a little bit that he was the odd man out. Now, he had crossed that 5 years of service time threshold, so he would have had a little bit of say in, hey, I'm not going to accept an option. You'll have to DFA me or try to find a home for me. Can you take us through a little bit of where you think Cavan maybe was as they had this conversation with him and he has to decide, hey, do I accept an option to the minors? Do I try my hand getting designated for assignment? And I don't know where I might end up via trade or waivers. How tough a spot is that probably for Cavan Biggio?
Oh, wow. Yeah. I spoke to Cavan and he said he was crushed. He was devastated. He was shocked. And I can understand the feeling. I remember playing quite a few years with the Orioles, and not returning to the Orioles is a shock. And so this is the only organization that Biggio has known. And Biggio is a major league player, just period, no doubt about it. And in my opinion, he's an everyday major league second baseman. Now, is he an everyday major league second baseman for the New York Yankees? I'm not 100% sure. But I just feel like if no matter what, some team gave him 550 at-bats, he's going to do pretty much what he did in 2019. Maybe even better because he has more control of the barrel. Now, I understand that a lot of people are going to disagree with me, but he is, in my opinion, he's a pro's pro. And I've seen the work ethic. I know that he can produce at that level. So there's no doubt in my mind that he will be picked up. There's probably a waiver wire fight right now over who's going to get him. So with that being said, there's no shot that if I was Cavan Biggio, I'm going to the minor leagues just to appease the team that drafted me and developed me. And I've spent, I think it is some 9 years with, there's no shot. I'm not going to the minor leagues. I'm saying no, DFA me, because I will be picked up in a matter of hours. And I believe that he'll be on the team really, really shortly and producing and playing. If it's on a contender, he'll be the perfect 26th man for a contender. And if he's not on a contender, he'll be playing every day for some other team. So a huge loss, in my opinion, just because of the professionalism that he brings. I do believe that if he was given legit straight 500 at-bats, he would be a very, very, very productive player like he was. I think it was 2019, his first year in the big leagues. You go look up those numbers in 19 when he had some 400 at-bats. They're pretty good. And then every year after that, he didn't get close to it. So, but look, Horwitz is, he's a nice looking player. He made some really nice plays on defense yesterday. He obviously swings the bat. I like what he brings. And the organization was at a point where they kind of went a little bit younger and with a guy that was knocking down the door, and you can't blame him for that. So hopefully he's able to come in and contribute, and hopefully Cavan's able to find a spot, and maybe it's a win-win for everybody.
Biggest thing you're looking for from Horwitz with this jump, is it the additional amount of velocity he's going to see at the major league level versus AAA?
I'm just looking for him to be who he is. This is a very difficult position to come in as a young player who's trying to establish himself. And you know what's going on as a player coming into the situation. You know the offense has been struggling. You know you're coming up because you're tearing the cover off the ball. You're moved up to the top of the order right out the gate. And you're balancing trying to be the guy, establish yourself as a major leaguer, because he does not want to go back. But then also there's a 5% way, way, way back in the back of the mind that you're thinking that you need to really, really do some stuff to help this offense. And I want him to just be who he is. He's a doubles guy who gets on base. I think the last phase of major league hitting is developing power. And especially when you have a very pure hitter in Spencer Horwitz, great eye, really nice swing, ball to bat skills off the charts. And so I think developing the power and really chasing that power is loft 2 inches out in front. It's catching it two seams out in front. And so you learn how to mess with loft as you grow as a major league hitter. And so if he can just stay within and continue doing what he's doing, that's what I'm looking for. I don't think he's going to have any problem really adjusting if he stays within and does that. Now, if he tries to get frisky and catch it off front and going for that loft, it's going to kind of jack him up a little bit. So hopefully there's a bunch of accidents out in front where he does hit some home runs. But if he's getting on base and driving the ball and doubles are like you said, doubles are great. If he getting on base and driving doubles, I think he'll be exactly what the Blue Jays need him to be.
And three righty starters from the Brewers, so should see plenty of them. Caleb Joseph, thanks so much for taking the time out this morning, man.
Yep, you got it. Thanks, Blake.
Caleb Joseph of Sportsnet, of Blue Jays Central. A lot of great analysis there. A lot of great analysis from him throughout the course of that series. He will be on with Jamie Campbell for this series as well as the Jays take on the Brewers. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll go to Vancouver for a Vancouver Canadiens coach who will be in St. Mary's this weekend, being inducted into the Canadian Baseball Hall of Fame. Ashley Stevenson joins us next as Jays Talk Plus continues on the Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360.
Unrivaled insight, analysis, and opinions on all things Blue Jays. Blair and Barker. Be sure to subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy. A fun weekend of baseball for the Jays in Oakland. Fun week ahead at Milwaukee. And then with Cleveland being here on the weekend, if you are a baseball fan around these parts, though, your attention on the weekend, at least on Saturday, may go to St. Mary's, Ontario, where the Canadian Baseball Hall of Fame and Museum will induct their 2024 class, which includes Russell Martin, Jimmy Key, and our next guest, coach with the Vancouver Canadiens and one of the greatest Canadian baseball players of all time, Ashley Stevenson. Ashley, good morning. Welcome, and thank you for doing this.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
So I guess, first of all, congratulations. I know it hasn't officially happened yet. It's happening this coming weekend. But I imagine that meant a lot to you. What was your reaction when you found out a couple months back, and how excited are you for this weekend?
I found out in January, actually a few weeks before it was announced. Scott gave me a call, and I mean, honestly, I was really surprised, completely honored. But yeah, it was a really great day. I was able to share it with just a couple people. And then once it was released a few weeks later, had a huge outpouring of support. So that was really great to see. I'm really looking forward to coming home. I've been gone since February for spring training and then flew directly out west. I just think it's going to be a great few days celebrating Canadian baseball, and really excited to get to chat and share stories with the other inductees and their support system. So it should be great.
So I wonder how much, like, your career went so quickly from player to coach that I wonder, did you even have the time, you know, to really, really reflect on your career as a player and just, you know, again, you're one of the greatest Canadian baseball players of all time. You know, widely regarded, this is what the write-up says, widely regarded as the best player in women's national team history. Because you moved so quickly into coaching, is this kind of the first time you've really got to reflect on what you accomplished as a player?
I think I always knew I was going to transition to coaching really quickly. Like, I love the game. I've been a teacher for 16 years. And so it's like, you know, it kind of fluid in the same type of thing, teaching and coaching. You know, I had a really lengthy career. I love baseball. I love being on the diamond and around the team and stuff like that. So I always wanted to transition to be a coach. So it was kind of natural that it happened pretty quickly for me. I had talked to Andre, who was the former national team manager, a few years before I even retired, and told him that, you know, I eventually wanted to join the staff and stuff. So it was pretty well documented that I wanted to do that. And I'm really grateful that they gave me an opportunity to do that so quickly. In terms of my playing career, like, I love to play and I love to compete and I love to be around my teammates. I don't know if I've really taken a lot of time to think about my career. When I get together with former teammates and friends, you know, we share stories about, like, the glory days and the good old days and stuff like that. But those are the memories that are kind of really special to me. Not necessarily medals and championships. Like, I love winning, but yeah, just being around the team and stuff like that, you know, met some of my best friends. So that's kind of like what I love about it. I don't know if I've taken a lot of time to reflect on my playing days, and I don't know if I will. Really looking forward to how my journey in baseball is going to continue.
I know you said that the teammates and the camaraderie are the more important parts, but there are a lot of medals. There are some MVPs and some championships and things like that. Is there anything that stands out from your playing career that, like, hey, this was the highlight, this is the thing I cherish most or appreciated the most?
Yeah, for me, I think it was 2015 Pan Am Games. So it's the first time ever that women's baseball was in a multi-sport games. In, you know, having it at home, we often travel abroad. It's difficult for family, friends to watch. You know, they're great support systems, but they don't actually get to come and watch us very often. So having that at home was really special. The COC was in charge of that. They did a phenomenal job. It really felt like a mini Olympics. And, you know, women's baseball isn't in the Olympic Games, so I think that's as close as we're going to get to it. And hopefully we get back to another Pan Am Games. I think it was really special, certainly for me, like being at Canada House and supporting the other athletes, like living in the village, just things that we never get to do necessarily at a world championship or anything like that. But yeah, I had all my family there and friends, and I had like students and teachers coming support me and stuff like that. So it was really kind of special to have it A, at home, and B, a multi-sport event.
So you mentioned that you had kind of started thinking about coaching while you were still playing. That transition came pretty naturally. How did you first get connected with the Blue Jays themselves? I know you coach at the Academy Canadian Futures Showcase, and then you had guest coached down at the Complex League. And then last year you joined the Vancouver Canadiens full time. Can you walk me through a little bit of how you got connected with the Blue Jays so quickly post-career?
I don't know if it was so quickly. Like a little bit of the background story is, so Wayne Perreault was with our national team program, and he coached me years ago, 15, 20 years ago, knew that I was a teacher, and they had these Blue Jays amateur camps that they did. And they still do them. They do a great job with them. And he asked if I wanted to help do some of those in the summer, since he knew I had a little bit of time off, thought it would be great to have some female instructors, et cetera. So I kind of got connected with the Blue Jays like 10, 12 years ago, doing that type of stuff. And, you know, I think having a teaching background and then a baseball background, it was just kind of natural. And then the MLB had to take the field conferences and stuff like that. And the stars really aligned for me when the lockout actually happened, because the Take the Field conference, you have to send in like a resume, cover letter, and answer a bunch of questions to be selected as part of the program. And Liz Benn, who's now with the Mets, but I actually played with her years ago, she was in charge of that program. And she thought, well, there's probably a lot of general managers and AGMs, you know, looking for things to do right now because of the lockout, and nobody knew when it was going to end. So she sent out a bunch of these resumes and cover letters, and it just so happened that mine landed on the Blue Jays desk. And yeah, and then Joe Sheehan, I think, started asking some questions. And, you know, I might have been one of the only Canadians taking part, and I live 45 minutes from Rogers Center. And so, yeah, like a bunch of little things kind of aligned, and it worked out for me. But I don't know if it was so quick. It probably was 10, 12 years in the making.
Sorry, I guess I meant quick after you finished playing. But yes, I didn't realize it had been going on that long in the background as well. So now you've been with the Vancouver Canadiens. Your first year there, you guys win the championship. That must have been pretty cool. But how has you know, this first season and change being full-time with one minor league affiliate, how has that been for you?
Really amazing. The Jays have done an excellent job kind of welcoming me, and the players have been outstanding, coaching staff. It really has been great. I love that I'm actually able to stay in Canada and still coach in Canada, albeit it's on the other side of the country, but that's okay. A beautiful place to be. But it's really nice that it's a career, right? Like I never dreamed that that would be a possibility for me. Grew up watching the Blue Jays, pretending at, you know, 6, 7 years old, I was going to be a Blue Jay. And then, you know, to now have an opportunity to work for an organization that I grew up watching and cheering for and stuff like that, it's pretty special. But to have my 100% focus on a job that I really love, and something that, you know, was a hobby of mine for a long time that I've turned into a career, seems a little bit surreal, but it's been a great experience.
So in your role with the Canadiens. What is your day-to-day like? I know it's position coach. It's kind of sounds like you just bounce around where whoever needs you that day, whatever they need help with. Is that kind of the right read on it?
We have like coaches for specific positions. So I'm at first base a couple of times a week. For the most part, I'm in charge of outfield, do a lot of advanced scouting on other teams' pitchers, stuff like that. So there's lots of analytics we all know in baseball. And so, you know, the Jays are no different. We do our due diligence and researching and scouting other teams prior to playing, et cetera. So I have a large role in that. But yeah, you know, in the minor leagues, you don't have a coach for everything and you wear a lot of hats. So it's been a great experience for me getting to do different things. But primarily, I'm at first base and I work with the outfielders and do a lot of base running stuff.
Nice. So I don't want to put you on the spot here, but I know that's a team that stole a lot of bases so far this year. Deson Brown, Ryan McCarty, Jeff Wehler. I won't put you on the spot for anyone, but that process, the base running side, is that a lot of fun? Like to see guys start to get it a little bit and their reads and their timing, their base stealing efficiency, to see that go in the right direction?
Yeah, there's so many details of things that can go into it. And, you know, having video on other teams is really helpful to be able to do a pre-scout and to give them some information. It's really fun to see guys just absorb the information so quickly, or, you know, you're working on things, you're talking to them about things, you know, week after week after week. And then when it finally clicks for them, it is really, you know, it's fun. And usually they give you the little, like the smile or the wink when they get to second base, like, yes, that was a tell, or that was, you know, something that you gave me or something like that. But Deson Brown, another Canadian, actually has just been absolutely unreal on the base paths for us this year. Like obviously he has just flat out speed, and so people don't really give him credit for the smarts he has on the base pass, because they just assume because he's so fast he gets to steal bases, and certainly that helpful for him. But he's a smart base runner. He made some changes from last year and he's had a really great start to his season, and so proud of him, like proud of all of our guys. But you know, you threw out some names, so I'll add his to the list. And he's a Canadian, right? So you got to represent there too.
I had to do it. He's 12 for 13 on the bases so far. So far, so good. Ashley, for anyone who doesn't know, you were also a university level hockey player at Laurier and played professionally. I know you weren't involved in the PWHL, but from afar, how cool was it for you to see that, see the success, see the crowds that they were able to draw out this year?
I absolutely loved it. I was able to get tickets actually to the first ever game. A friend of mine, you know, knew somebody who couldn't go, was on vacation because it was actually New Year's. And so somehow I snagged two tickets, and literally listening to the national anthem had tears in my eyes. And I was like, I didn't know why I was so emotional, but it had been so long and I was so happy for those players. And, you know, I just thought of a lot of my teammates and stuff who had been through, you know, the ringer of just trying to get some respect and, you know, and have people respect and appreciate our game and stuff like that. So, you know, the WNBA has done a fantastic job. Soccer has done an amazing job fighting for some equal rights and equal pay. And tennis has led the charge for a long time with Billie Jean King. And so it kind of came full circle that she was one of the, you know, founding members kind of for this PWHL. But I am so happy that, you know, it went so well. Everybody's a little bit nervous when something like that starts. You want it to have success. And I don't think anybody would be telling you the truth if they thought that it was, you know, they knew it was going to go that well. But I got to a couple of games before I left for spring training, and, you know, I watched online and stuff like that. But it's been outstanding and it's, you know, well deserved.
And hopefully that, I mean, you kind of painted the picture there of the momentum in women's sports there. Hopefully that can keep translating to the baseball and softball side as well. Fun NCAA tournament going on right now. Do you keep it? I guess did you play university ball? Were you just focused on the hockey while you were there?
No, I only played hockey. Okay. And then played ball all summer. So switch seasons, switch sports.
And now you're in Vancouver, where you could do both a little closer to year round. Ashley, thank you so much for taking the time out. Really hope you have a blast this weekend.
Thank you very much for having me.
Congratulations again, Ashley Stevenson of the Vancouver Canadiens, heading into the Canadian Baseball Hall of Fame this weekend. The resume is ridiculous on the hockey side. And then you get to the baseball side, which is like five times longer. It should be a lot of fun. Russell Martin, I think, is going to be on Blair and Barker this week. I should have double-checked that before saying it. Jimmy Key won't be at the induction ceremony, but he's being inducted as well. Buck Martinez being honored with an award that he won last year but wasn't able to pick up last year. So should be a fun one in St. Mary's, Ontario. And you can search up the Canadian Baseball Hall of Fame for more details on that. We're going to set up this Brewers series. But first, Rogers has announced an exciting new national contest. Bring Stanley home to send Rogers customers and hockey fans from across Canada to the Stanley Cup Final in Edmonton. Rogers customers have the chance to win 10 VIP trips for two to attend Game 4 in Edmonton on Saturday, June 15th. This prize also includes travel and accommodation, plus premium viewing at a game day concert outside Rogers Place. Visit rogers.com/Stanley Cup to enter for your chance to win. And for more details, that's rogers.com/Stanley Cup. That would be pretty cool. Game 4 in Edmonton. So you have three choices on Saturday. You could win one of those VIP trips and go to Game 4 in Edmonton. You could go to the Canadian Baseball Hall of Fame in St. Mary's, Ontario. You can watch the Jays against the Guardians. The Guardians, who, by the way, are at the top of the AL Central. Before they get to the Guardians, the Jays will have to play the Milwaukee Brewers, who are at the top of the NL Central. They are 38-27. They have a commanding 6.5 game lead in the division already because nobody else in that division is above 500. Nobody else in that division even has a record as good as the Blue Jays, which is obviously damning with faint praise there. Most of those teams with a negative run differential as well. So it's been a weird and down year for the NL Central. The AL Central, of course, kind of mirrors that, but the Kansas City Royals overperforming to the degree that they have changes the color on that one. The NL Central has fairly clearly been the worst division in baseball. I guess the NL West has an argument there as well. Here's the shocker, and this will maybe not shock you when you hear that the Blue Jays are two games out of a wild card spot. Not a lot of good teams around this year. Watching Yankees and Dodgers on the weekend, it is pretty striking how much better those two teams feel than pretty much anyone other than maybe the Phillies and Orioles in addition to those two. So anyway, this Brewers team is 38-27. They have got it done mostly on the offensive side and with their bullpen, because this is a team that, like we talked about with Tim Dillard, has a load of guys on the IL on the pitching side. So they're already without Devin Williams, their closer, the airbender changeup, who's been dealing with that stress fracture in his back all season. But their starting rotation lost Corbin Burns to trade, lost DL Hall, one of the pieces they got back in that trade, to injury. Lost Joe Ross, Wade Miley, Jacob Junis. This is an entire rotation on the IL. So what they've been left with instead is Freddie Peralta, who has been quite good at the top of that rotation. We won't see him this weekend, but he's got a 3.95 ERA. That's been nice for them. But it's been cobbled together a little bit. So we're going to see Colin Ray tonight. We'll also see, it's rumored that Carlos F. Rodriguez, one of their prospects, will get called up for Tuesday's start. We'll tee you up for that if that gets confirmed tomorrow. Tobias Myers is slated to start Game 3. Colin Ray is an interesting one. He's kind of bounced all over, including a stint in Japan. I am a little skeptical, I'll say, to say it nicely, that his 3.53 ERA is going to sustain. This is a guy who's always given up a lot of home runs and plays in a pretty hitter-friendly park. The home run rate is down a little bit this year, but that's not backed up by a lot. It seems like early season noise. His expected ERA, based on how often you miss bats, walks, quality of contact, is more than two runs higher than his actual ERA. And sometimes you can outperform that. We've talked about a couple Blue Jays guys who have been able to beat that by, you know, half a run over the course of a season because of pitchability. Hey, this can't capture the fact that you do a better job keeping guys guessing or keeping them off balance. There's something the numbers can't capture in the way you pitch, etc. To that, I would say two things when it comes to Colin Ray. One is that I don't believe that anyone could keep up like a full two plus runs of ERA differential like that. I don't like it. The examples of it happening in the history of baseball are so rare that you would have to have a really convincing case as to why Colin Ray is able to do that and nobody else can really do that. The other thing is that you dig into the stuff, right? And you're like, what is this guy throwing? Why would he maybe be deceptive? And you do get one point in his favor, which is that he throws six different pitches and he throws them all a pretty reasonable amount. So against righties, he's going to lead with a sinker. It's only 92 and it will get hit for average. It doesn't have very good results at all this year, but it's his main pitch. It's his lead pitch. He'll also mix in a cutter. So if you think back to our conversation last week with Justin Choi about how pitchers, especially pitchers without elite velocity, are trying to throw more sinkers and cutters in place of the four-seamer, Colin Ray is a good example of that. Again, both of those get hit decently for average and for power, but in terms of how it sets up the plate appearance, he clearly sees something in using those pitches. You know, the two of them combined for about half his pitches. Righties are going to see sweeper and curveball. Lefties are going to see a lot more of the straight fastball, some sweeper, and then a split finger. He'll throw all six pitches to either side, but that's mostly what you're looking at. None of those pitches are particularly good swing and miss. He'll get some on the split finger, but that's really it. And then it's the split finger and the sweeper that have actual good results. So you might look at that and say, well, why doesn't he throw those more? Maybe if he threw them more, guys would catch up to it. Maybe it's the element of having to stay ready for three different fastballs and the sweeper and the splitter that makes them effective. So again, color me a little skeptical that this is going to keep up long-term, but if he managed to six-pitch magic his way against the Blue Jays, given what they've done offensively so far this season, it would not be the most shocking thing in the history of the world. Also, the Blue Jays have not seen this guy. Justin Turner is 1-for-7 against him in his career. Daniel Vogelbach's 0-for-3, and that's it. He has spent, you know, time obviously in Japan and his entire career in the National League beyond that. So the Blue Jays have not seen much of him at all. On the other side, Jose Berríos has seen a little bit more of the Brewers, 50 plate appearances, and he's held them to a 174 batting average with a 38% strikeout rate. So that's pretty good. Now, that is concentrated on a handful of guys. He's really had Gary Sanchez's number. He's really had Jake Bauer's number. And then he's really had Christian Yelich's number, 0-for-9 there. So this is a better version of Christian Yelich this year. He is back, by the way, to kind of being full Christian Yelich. I remember early in the year, I asked someone around the Brewers, was he back? And they said, well, the thing about back injuries is no one has ever had back issues. Back issues never become past tense. You're always dealing with them. Having said that, he's been a monster this year. He's hitting .324, six homers, six stolen bases, OPS up over 900. When we control for, you know, league environment and things like that, you have to go back to 2019 for the last time that Christian Yelich was hitting this well. So that's a threat. We talked about with Tim Dillard that William Contreras is probably one of the most underrated players in the league. And then the big thing to watch for, I think, in this series is that this is a top five base running team and a top five defensive team. You're going to see them play all their positions fairly well, and they'll run. And when I say they'll run, yeah, Bryce Turang leads the team in that regard, but everyone on this team will run at least a little bit. And I mean that from a stolen base perspective, but I also mean that in that they'll do a good job taking extra bases and things like that. 14 different Brewers this year have stolen bases and 10 different guys have three or more. So you are looking at a pretty deep team when it comes to pushing the envelope running. The Blue Jays have done a better job controlling the run game as the season's gone along, but it's still not the strength of their pitching staff being able to control the run game, make sure guys can't get jumps. And again, you know, catchers can erase some of those errors, but the Blue Jays catchers are maybe not the ones who are going to do that. They grade out as kind of fine with that, but they're not making up for the fact that the pitchers are a little slower to the plate. So it should be an interesting one. Jose Berríos is on a nice little roll here too, by the way. We'll see. This is a Brewers team that can really hit the ball. Tim mentioned they fell out of the top 10 in home runs because they played in some pitcher's parks of late, but they are fifth in the league in runs per game. They're sixth in OPS. They're sixth in weighted runs created plus if we control for park factors and things like that. And as much as the Jays have struggled for early offense, you do want to get to Colin Ray early and put some runs on the board, because this is a Brewers team that, yes, can protect the lead because they're a very good defensive team and they have a top 10 bullpen by ERA and the number one bullpen in terms of workload, how many innings they've pitched. They will also, though, they can small ball their way back into a game to add an insurance run if you only have a one-run lead. So it really does feel like it'll be imperative in this one to get up early and try to hang on to that. We had some questions in the text line. I'm not going to get to them today other than one. Scott from Brantford asked on Friday, do we think the Jays will pull off a trade to add some bullpen depth soon? If so, have you heard any names? Not yet. I don't think soon because, you know, this is not what this front office has done historically. They haven't pulled the trigger all that early, with the Adam Simber example being the counter there, I guess. I think they would try internal options first. Nick from Toronto had asked the other day about giving Hagen Danner a shot in the pen in place of one of Cabrera or Little or Ryan Burr when he was still with the team. He'd be the next guy up that we haven't seen yet. Like, his AAA numbers are the strongest. The reports on him have been the best. So he would be the next name up. But I think you're looking at, hey, how's Eric Swanson doing? What is Jordan Romano's timeline like? If Little came out, I guess Ryan Burr has to stay down there a certain amount of time now because there wasn't an injury. But, you know, he'd be in the mix there as well. So it's going to be a really interesting series here. This is a very good Brewers team, one that maybe doesn't have the high-end name value, but it gets going tonight at 8:10. It'll be Dan, Joe, and Hazel on the call, Jamie and Caleb for Blue Jay Central, Ben and Chris on the radio, Shy's there on the ground, Blair and Barker will have you from 4 to 6. They'll also have you for post-game afterward. Thank you to about-to-be Hall of Famer Ashley Stevenson of the Vancouver Canadiens for coming on, to Tim Dillard, to Caleb Joseph and Caitlin McGrath for joining us as well. Thank you to Lance Kennedy and Amit Mon and Jennifer Rolnick behind the glass. We will talk to you at 10 a.m. tomorrow. Maybe the Blue Jays are back to 500 by then. Maybe not. Hope you have a wonderful Monday.